So all these people, all these things, but like I blew it all off to get back into bike racing because the whole scene, I love bikes more. And I went on a mission, and that was this thing called a mountain bike.
There are individuals in every sport who create change. There are characters in every sport who, if you meet them in person, you will never forget. Eric Bjorling and I were joined in our virtual studio by a person who forever changed our sport and who is a truly memorable character. Gary Fisher's name is synonymous with the mountain bike and the sport it has empowered. In our conversation, we discuss Gary's formative years in California, some interesting characters who influenced him, his many accomplishments on a road bike, and the early days on Mount Tam. We also learned about Gary's new book, appropriately titled, Being Gary Fisher and the Bicycle Revolution. Gary teamed up with some of the best minds in cycling journalism and art to tell his remarkable story. The book, a perfect gift for any cyclist, is available exclusively at trekbikes.com and Trek retailers nationwide. And the man, indeed the legend, is available to you on Better With Bikes right now. We are so excited today to have in our virtual studio, Gary Fisher. This has been a podcast in the works for some time. I'm glad that it is happening today, and we have a lot to talk about. Welcome, Gary Fisher.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks, everyone. Awesome.
It's
great.
So Eric and I have been talking about this one for a while, and we're using this particular opportunity because we have some exciting news of a new book to talk about. So I wanted to start, Gary, and have you explain, where did the idea come from to tell the story, and who helped you along the way?
Well, I've never really thought of myself as a writer. You know that? And the conflict with that was that I wrote for Bicycling Magazine for 8 years, you know, and that job got thrown at me to be a road tester for bicycling. And I said, I want to do this. And I wasn't a really good student in English, but I forced myself to learn to write enough to where I could write a monthly column. I did it for 8 years, and I quit doing it. I never thought I'd do it again. And it was, you know, John Burke, the president of our company, Trek Bicycle, that said, Gary, I've heard so many of your stories. You got to write the book. And he kept saying that to me.
I want to follow the timeline, because you've introduced us in the book to your story and your family story, but then to really the origins of how bikes grew and were used throughout this period of time, in California in particular. So one of the things I've appreciated learning more over time is where your own journey with the bicycle began. Many people in the industry immediately jump to mountain bikes, but there's so much more that led you there. Can you give us some of the highlights of that early time on the bike?
Well, I was a kid. I was like 12 years old. And Now I started hanging out in this bike shop. And I, you know, it was before I hung out at the bike shop. I'd go around with my friends when I was like 10, 11 on three speeds, Raleigh three speeds. And I had two friends that we go all over the place and we go really fast. And then I discovered a whole nother level of it at the local bike shop, which is about a mile and a half away. And I'd ride over there and right away was like, all right, I got to get this together and go with these guys. And I went on a ride that I just said, can I go on a ride with you? And they said, no, you're too little. You can't come with us, you know? And it was these guys, you know, 15, 16, 18. And I said, come, I'm going with you. And I just rode. And they said, okay, you can come with us, you know? And that was it. I started riding with these guys. And then when it was, that started it, you know? And my parents got involved to a degree, but it was only after I'd already started going on rides, like the Sunday ride would be like 80 miles. And his old Englishman, Larry Walpole, he was from East London. He was a mechanic for Pan Am. He was president of the BBC, that is the Belmont Bicycle Club. And that was my start right there. I'd go on the rides, and there was one guy that was a good racer. I mean, there were 120 riders in the Amateur Bicycle League of America, and almost everybody that could ride a bike seriously joined. Now, that was in Northern California, 120 riders, and they were saying, hey, this thing is like going off, you know? It's like incredible, you know, the whole thing. And that was the big craze. I mean, you knew everybody that rode at that time, and we were definitely outsiders on the road, yeah. You know? But
you went on to take that to racing and quite a bit as a road rider that I'm not sure many in our audience appreciate.
I rode in track. You know, I rode the first year I rode 30 races. 30, you know, 3-0, you know, and like the last race of the year, I was able to hang into the field because I was intermediate, which was, you know, I was like 12 going on 13. And I was racing against guys that were 17. You know, because my class was 12, 13, 14. And that year, that first year, I got second in the district championships. There were only four kids in my class. You know, it was like that. There was one woman in the whole district that raced that first year. The second year that I raced, there were like four, you know. Audrey McElmory, there she was. She won the world championships. She was in San Diego, and she came to some races.
Well, take us through the move, first from Southern California to Northern California, but also from road riding and track riding to places outdoors, maybe Mount Tam.
Well, that was, I started racing. We lived on the peninsula of San Francisco. That was in Burlingame. Then when I was 15, we moved to Marin. And it was really different for me because it was like all of a sudden I was pulled away from all my regular training buddies. Mm-hmm. So then there was a race going on called the Tour del Mar. And a friend of ours, you know, in the Belmont Bike Club, Tom Pruse, he was the promoter of this thing. And he was a great promoter, you know, and he had a couple of rock and roll bands. He had the Grateful Dead and the Quicksilver Messenger Service play. And before the gig, they had this parade. Started in the, you know, the Dead and the Quicksilver Messenger Service were in open convertible cars. There were about 40 bike riders. And we all rode from the ferry building, went to the Playboy Club. But I couldn't go. I was too young. Then it went off to City Hall. We got the key from the mayor. Then we went down to El Camino Real, and I got the key from the mayor of Redwood City. It was all to get in the press, and it got a lot of press. And then the race was held out in Pescadero, was a headquarters, which is out closer to the ocean. It's beautiful out there, but there's nothing there. And they had a dance concert in the IDES Hall out there. And I'll tell you, less than 100 people showed up, you know, all three nights in a row combined. And I met the band, you know, and I started hanging out the band, and I ran away from home, and I lived with the Grateful Dead. And I worked with them a lot, you know, did a lot of things with them and the airplane, Jefferson Airplane. And also worked for people involved with the thing, like a guy named The Bear, who did the Wall of Sound and other good things, you know. So it was a whole revolutionary time. I mean, one time I got picked up on Haight Street, went to jail with Jack Leary, Timothy's son. We used to hang out together, you know? It was like that. But right there in the very center, I march right into the center of the thing and go, hey, here I am, man. I want to hang out with you guys. And they go, okay, cool, you know? And I did light shows. That was a whole nother thing. And, you know, we had 10 people in the light show. It was crazy how many people we ended. My sort of partner in crime was this guy, Alan Cooper, who turned out to be the father of Visual Basic, you know, and turned out, like me, deals with big corporations, big business, all that, for many years in software development, and just the intuitive side of it. The author of the book, The Inmates Are Running the Asylum, which is about engineers and their place in the world. Nice. Anyways, it's, you know, all this stuff. And Stuart Brand. Oh, my God. Whole Earth Catalog. I worked on that thing, too. So all these people, all these things, but like I blew it all off to do, get back into bike racing, because the whole scene, I loved bikes more. And I went on a mission, and that was this thing called a mountain bike.
So where did the first idea, because I think you're also very clear, and I think you kind of cleared the air a little bit on your role in the creation of mountain biking. I think in the book you even say, look, I didn't create mountain biking. What I did is I created a lot of noise and popularity, and I moved the movement along. Tell us about those first few days, though, because you were certainly, even if you didn't create it yourself, you certainly were a part of that gestational period of the entire sport. What was that all like?
Well, it was, we had something that, you know, my mom passed away this year. God bless her. Ooh. But my mom would say to me, even last year, she'd say about the way that you handle the press is you're doing their job. She'd say, Gary, you're doing their job for them. And that was, you know, I'm giving you a story, man. And I had a story. This off-road story, this was the thing. And the thing about it, the magic about it, is you think about it, it's all about space. It's all about space. I mean, bikes would be incredibly popular in all the big cities if they had the space they need. And that is that, you know, that means there wouldn't be any space for these cars. That's a really a tough sell in the United States, you know. But honestly, it's just like what Paris is doing right now. They got it. You know, you got to have big time space for it. And then the thing, it take off. And the mountain bike, it had space. There was all this space out there, you know, that people weren't checking out. It was just wide open. And that was the big thing about it. It was like, it was a very, very practical thing. You know, and it enabled you to go out and enjoy the outdoors and a lot more of it, a lot easier and everything. That's what made it happen. You know, it's like we made the hardware for it, but the space was already there and all that, all this, the craziness. And then it was like the thing of like you're selling stuff that it had so much sizzle, you know what I mean? Because, and yet at the same time, it was a completely practical thing. I mean, half the people you'd say, we're going to go off and ride bikes in the woods, they'll say, you can't do that. That's crazy. And that was the perfect first reaction in a way, because the reality was, it's like, no, it's just really, you go on your own speed and everything. It's not that, it's a bike of super powerful brakes, you know, super wide ranges of gears and everything, you know, sit down and take it at your own pace and everything. And that's the thing.
How long do you think it took you guys before you realized, this isn't just something that I enjoy. This is something actually that could be massively popular worldwide. This could actually be a business.
Well, to be honest, you know, I was, you know, around for that whole happening in 73 when we had the gas wars and people got into bikes, you know, and it was really intoxicating because people were really realizing of how, what a wonderful thing it was. But I'll tell you, there was zero support. There were very few bike shops that were of any type of quality then. They couldn't handle the influx. The bikes were just, they were horrible too. You know, they're all like either race bikes or pseudo race bikes. You know, it wasn't right. People had nobody to help them ride the bikes, assemble the bikes, do anything. You know, and it was flat out a really stupid, impractical bike. I used to put bikes together and work in a bike shop around those times, you know, and these things were awful, you know, just awful. And I thought, man, I could do a better job than this and make a good heavy duty bike, you know, that really works and everything. And I started making bikes for people and I was still racing, you know, and that was my number one thing was being a bike racer. And then we come 1979, and I'm at the Olympic Training Center, and Eddie B is saying to me, forget about it, you're too old. And I say, well, time to start the bike business, You know, that was it. You know, thank you, Eddie. You know, he got me started in a new direction. And that's when I took it really seriously and said, okay, let's do this and let's do this right. You know, that's when I created the name Mountain Bikes for my own company. You know, come on. And, you know, just started doing it, you know, going for it and asking for all kinds of advice and taking advice from people in my family, people around, and doing everything they said. And it was a steep learning curve for me. You know, I'd never went to business school, you know, but I certainly did learn it over the years. You know, I've seen a lot of stuff, you know.
Talk more about the product. So you mentioned there really wasn't the proper tool for the job. So you had to work on some perhaps trial and error. What was that process?
Well, in the, you know, the mongrel stage, which was, you know, go out and find things that already existed. That was like you get pre-World War II bikes because after World War II, old cruiser bikes, you know, like Schwinn's were great. Because after that, they lowered the bottom bracket because they wanted to fit kids. They admitted this is a kid's bike. Before that, it was sort of a fairly serious bike. I mean, an old Schwinn Excelsior X frame weighs 7 pounds and a frontal impact. We did a frontal impact test on it and it needed to hit 800 pounds. Well, the old Schwinn hit 1,100 pounds. A Gary Klein would hit 1,400 pounds. That's really good money, you know, and a regular road bike back in the day was 650 pounds. And that sort of like reflects how hard a human being can hang onto the bike and they get shucked. But, you know, you see people like in doing the jumps now these days and the way they hit stuff. Ooh, brother, that standard has gone way up there. You know, it's like we those bikes, you know, and then the bikes we created, you know, in like the late 70s, they were a total copy of a Schwinn Excelsior X frame design because that frame, we knew it handled well. The bike worked well at speed, you know, it handled well. It did everything. And except that you had straight tubes and you had all that, you know, just more road bike fitments. That is, you know, Campagnolo English dimension is what I like to use everywhere except for the bottom bracket. And the bottom bracket needed a sealed bearing. And there was a sealed bearing that the 2006 sealed bearing that Viscount was using at the time. And it's a really robust bearing and not the lightest thing in the world, but you put a 17 millimeter axle. That's a standard square taper axle. And then you go out and buy any crank at the time. And I started importing things. Well, that was, you know, the company. I started the company. There was before the company, after the company. Before the company, I'd just go and scrounge things. And I was working for Bicycling Magazine, so I met a lot of people in the industry, you know. And, you know, I had a pair of, you know, I knew the Shimano guys, all these people, and they could get all sorts of oddball parts. So, can you make me a frame? No, they weren't frame builders. And I was too busy being a road racer to get into it, you know. I had a bike that weighed 42 pounds, you know, big drum brakes on it, you know, like an 18 speed and everything. And I was super fit and nobody could drop me anywhere on any bike, you know, until the end of the 70s when people got faster bikes and everything.
So Eric mentioned this before, but now you have a product and you need to convince people that this is actually a worthwhile endeavor. Let's go away from pavement. Let's go up that mountain and maybe ride down even faster. How did you spread the word? How did you invite people to join you?
Well, it's a lot of print media and stuff on TV. I mean, one of the iconic TV shows was at the time was Evening Magazine. And they showed Coast to Coast. And they wanted to do an 8-minute segment on it, on us. And they did. And it was fantastic. It was... they won an award for the year for that particular segment, and I showed it a number of times. And myself and my roommate, Charlie Kelly, are the only two people mentioned and interviewed in the whole thing, you know, basically. And in there, I have the line, this has come a long ways, and this is going to go a long ways. Because it just, at that moment, it was just had that energy. I mean, Mark, it was like, I was a road racer. I mean, I was a good road racer, you know, first category for a long time. And barely anybody in town knew I did that so much or came to the races because they weren't in town. And the repack race, I mean, people talked about it in the bars in town. It was like people were excited about it because people would crash and do all sorts of crazy things. You know, they'd come out and watch a thing. And it was a regular event. It would happen every few weeks in the same location. Basic idea. Oh, my goodness. But it got people going, you know, and that was a really good indicator, you know, and then it kept coming, you know, like, and there were the majors came. I mean, you name it. I mean, Newsweek, Time, Popular Mechanics, Scientific American, you know, Cosmopolitan. Big. My mother would teach me, you go down to the newsstands, you look for the big, thick magazines with a lot of advertisers, you get yourself the ABC book, which is all, tells you all the circulations. You look for the biggest circulation, you get that masthead, start calling. And I would cold call people and say, I got a story for you. And I would sell it. You know, people get paid to do this like crazy these days, you know, but they do it all. Everybody does it socially, different things like that. I'm doing you a favor. I got a really cool story. You know, that's what it is. That's what it was. That's what it'll always be, you know, and in a way, but the medium changes, of course, you know.
You know, in the book that you there's a lot of the pages are dedicated to those first years of the mountain bike company, and then obviously the move into Fisher bikes as well. But it also talks, you've dedicated a lot of space to talking about essentially introducing the Japanese, who were going to be play a pivotal role in growing the sport. Talk a little bit about that too, because there's a lot of this book goes into it. It's some very interesting stories about your early days of going back and forth between the United States and Japan.
We had this little tiny office called Mountain Bikes, and we'd get visitors from the industry because we went to all the shows. We got into magazines and everything. I remember in the first couple of years, we had 500 visitors from Japan, about 30 from Europe and one from the United States of a manufacturer. That was it, you know? And the Japanese guys, I mean, they got it, man. I'd go to Japan, I mean, and I'd go see them all. You know, you go see, well, there was a Shimano side, which was Shimano and Takagi. That was about it. Shimano, Shimano, Shimano. And then there was the other side, which was a conglomerate of Suntour, you know, Nitto, Ishiwata, you know, Sanshin. You know, I've worked with all those little guys, you know. I mean, all of them. And I'd spill my guts. I'd give my best. This is what it's got to be. I mean, Sugino, you know, we made the AT or... You know, it was an AT crankset, you know, and they made all these different lengths and all these different chainring sizes. And they really dedicated themselves to it. And then in the end, I mean, I'd say to them, look, I'm going to dedicate myself to you, tell you everything. And I had other people in the industry were saying, no, we're not going to tell them anything. We'll keep it in a secret. And I said, why do you want to do that, man? You'll never get the stuff built. And it'll never get built. You know, these guys build like 100 here, 100 there. And I said, 100? I want 100,000. Come on, I got to make people happy. You know, you're talking small potatoes, you know? And these guys were churning out really good stuff and they cared about the quality like crazy, you know? And in the end, you know, I'd say, look, I'll tell you everything. I want first delivery, best price and terms. So they got me DA payments with the Japanese government, you know? They got together and did that for me. And it helped like crazy, man. You know, and they made the stuff. And I got the stuff first off. How did you get that? I worked with these guys. Come on, man. And, you know, and Mike Sinyard was there and a competitor. And that was good. Because once you get like five really good competitors, they all take you seriously then. This is a movement. It's more than a pioneer thing. You know, pioneering is not easy. You know,
do you remember Eric touched on this before that, you know, the road segment of course was, you know, so much larger and so much better, more established, but do you remember the point in time when you thought, wow, this this really is going to be huge.
Okay. Chuck McCullough, was the old editor for Bicycling Magazine. He ran an editorial, you know, on one issue of Bicycling. I think it was like in 84, 85, where I was so audacious as to say, when a person says bike, when they look at a mountain bike, they will just say bike, right? That's a bike. That's a normal bike. I was so audacious to say that. Put that in there because that's how fixated we were on a bike has this drop bar. That's the ultimate bike, you know?
That's probably still true today. If you showed somebody a mountain bike, entry level or whatever, they'd probably say, that's a bike.
That's a bike, yeah. Well, that's sort of how far we'd strayed off into like, well, if you're serious, you're going to have this drop bar bike. You know, the U.S. market, though, in the early 70s, it was a lot of drop bars and the little brothers and little sisters of drop bar bikes. There weren't that many three-speeds. There were very few. And that was the flat bar bike. There were very few adult flat bar bikes in those days. And you saw some cruisers, but not too many. It's surprising. Not too many. You saw Sundown in L.A. and everything. The whole market had like shifted way. You think we're shifted far into a road? Oh, as a percentage of sales, we were nothing but back then. It was really, there was not much available.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that, you know, people would show up for the repack races and racing was sort of always there and always a kind of a part of the soul of what you guys were creating. I'd like to hear your thoughts and your maybe a story or two of your memories about when racing sort of became a little bit more formalized in mountain bikes and what kind of impact that had for the sport.
Well, that happened, you know, in the 80s and 90s. You know, it really started to, you know, go into crazy money. It's sort of like what you're seeing in some of the e-bike racing and everything like that. They'll like throw together events and everything because, man, there's some money behind this and they're promoting it. And, you know, I remember, you know, showing up to an event and there'd be a helicopter, you know, there waiting on the tarmac next to the airplane saying, come on, Gary, you and some VIPs, we're all going, you know, and it's like crazy stuff where they're spending crazy money, you know, and events where they're bringing in big celebrities and everything. You know, they had that for a while in mountain biking that was going on, you know, and you know, big promotional events. I remember Michelin bringing every bike maker and their brother and all the journalists into a big place in Palm Springs and just, you know, flying people around and doing crazy stuff.
So let's talk
the intersection of you and Trek bikes. How did that happen? And can you tell us that story?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Bicycling Magazine, they said, Gary, we want to fly out to Wisconsin, do a story on this new bike company. And I looked at it and went, wow, look at this. National Cross Championships are happening the next week, or, you know, could happen the next weekend. I think I'll go out and hit both of them. So I flew out, you know, to Madison, and I met the Burks, and I went to the factory, and wow, I was impressed. You know, I knew how you were supposed to make a bike frame, a good steel frame, and they were doing everything right, everything the right way, you know, and they were hand-building wheels and everything, and it just... And the way, you know, Dick Burke was talking about expanding it and everything, I was going, this is going to work. You know, these guys have, you know, this is a quality piece and everything. And so I took photos, I took a lot of notes, and I jumped on the airplane for a really short flight. I flew to Milwaukee and I had my cross bike with me in a backpack. And I jumped on my bike and rode from the airport into town where the cross race was going to be held and went out to the course. And it was like nobody out there. And it was like 2 days before the race. I couldn't find my friends. You know, I couldn't find the phone numbers or nothing. You know, there was no internet in those days. It's hard to hook up with people and everything. So I went off, you know, I rode, you know, to the closest motel I could find, which is about 10 miles away. And I check in and I wake up, you know, late at night. It says, oh, it's going to snow about 6-8 inches, you know, and wake up in the morning, there's 10 inches of snow on the ground. And I'm going, oh, man. these California kids out there. And I took all the newspapers I could find there, and I stuffed them in all the clothes I could wear, get on my cross bike, and hey, it was easy. Cross bike goes great in the snow, you know? So I rode across town, get out to the cross course, and there's all my friends, you know? And they're all staying in some big mansions right close to the course. And I went and rode the race, and I got 10th place. I didn't do well at all that day. But that was that was my first time. And then I wrote a story called A Giant is Growing in the Midwest for Bicycling Magazine. That was a long time ago. And you guys grew, you know, the right attitudes, right thing. And I watch you guys from our sales staff at the trade shows. I watch the Trek guys. And my guys would be making fun of the Trek guys. And I'd say, look, when your sales are like the Trek guy sales, you can make fun of them.
So tell me more. You've shared with me in previous conversations that you appreciated and you learned some lessons from Dick Burke. What were those?
Yeah. Well, to listen. You know, he'd listen. And he'd listen to the whole story. And he'd do it with everybody. You know, would spend the time. And then you felt like, listened to. And you realize, you know, you can learn something from almost everybody. You know, that's it. And tune into the human condition, really. And it's important.
When did the business lines then cross? You talked about the first meeting, but it was a few years later that there was an opportunity to combine talents.
Oh, man. That's when, like, we were like, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. You know, I'd basically sold the company. It was outside of my control, and installed a general manager that lied to me on a regular basis, you know, and it was a mess. And as it turned out, my corporate attorney was the hero, you know. He taught me exactly what to do, you know. And offers had come in from, we were distressed, things were going to heck, you know, down the tubes in so many ways. And offers were coming in from other people, and a general manager, like, there, brought in a liquidator that, like, would put all the offers in his back pocket, and built a shell company down in LA to, like, buy the final assets of Fisher and everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, anyway, it's in the book what I did about all this stuff, because I wanted to go with Trek. I didn't want to go with these other fly-by nights, and I certainly didn't want to be sold down the river.
It's a great story in the book. It's got a comic book vibe to it, which is really, really fun. Some great illustrations actually in there. And yeah, it really does kind of dovetail also with some classic Trek photography of the old factory in there too. So that's a fun part of the book for sure.
I do appreciate the symmetry that perhaps one of your very first visits to Trek involved cyclocross. And if I remember correctly, perhaps one of your most recent ones pre-pandemic involved cyclocross in our backyard.
It's the best. That's a great course. You know, it's such a fun event going there. You know, everybody's so stoked to be there and everything. And you guys don't fool around. You bring in the world's best. You know, that's what I like. You know, you don't cheap out on it. You know, it's like, that's what you're supposed to do. And you know, if you want the best reaction, you've got to have
a front row seat at some of the best places in the world to ride a bike. What are the places that really inspire you along the lines of what you're saying we need to do when you think of the places that are doing it well?
Right. Well, here's an example. Seoul, Korea. You know, they decide we're going to put in bike paths. And so they put in 250 kilometers worth of bike paths. Boom, big wide ones, you know, big. They do it right, you know. And of course, Paris now, that's incredible what's going on there, you know. And London has, made some advances. There's a lot of pushback there. Of course, Barcelona is opening up its whole area.
You've seen the world and often behind the handlebars. You've ridden everywhere in every type of cycling. Talk about the riding you do today.
Today, it's mostly I'm staying fit or I'm going out with my kids. I got two little kids right now. I got a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. And it's been amazing. Actually, Mark, it's been, they don't want me to ever leave again. And we have so much fun, you know, and they, you know, a little girl, she's 2.5. She rides a kick bike and she's pretty fast and good balance and everything. And a little boy, he rides just a little, you know, 16-inch wheel bike. We go around and then I take him in the bike trailer and I've also got an electric cargo bike. I take them a lot. And then I ride my road bike a lot, you know, just for the exercise. That's what I'm doing mostly, you know, right now. It'll morph, it'll shift, that's for sure.
When you visit some of those places where you were first riding, and especially up in the mountains in Marin, what goes through your mind when you see bikes everywhere and being used in so many ways? What's going on in the world of Gary?
Well, I've always loved to just the fact that you put on a helmet and glasses, you can sort of disappear into you know, be a regular person, a fly on the wall, so to speak, and just sort of and ride with people, ride like a regular person. You know, I like to be able to go into that, you know, and I can do that here. You know, it's pretty good, but people figure out who I am some of the time, you know, but I like people, you know, so I have a good time with it. You know, it's, I go out, to be honest though, a lot of time I go out by myself on my road bike early in the morning, you know, 5:30 and start the ride in the dark, you know, thank goodness for all the good lights that we have these days and just go do the thing. I mean, you know, that's good, but I love going to Northern Italy and riding with the people that are just really the organized rides. You see people riding side by side and you talk and you pull off the back and you ride. Ah, that's so much fun. And if I could do it, I'd still race. You know, if I still had all the horsepower, I don't have the horsepower like back in the day. I loved racing. Oh, I didn't, you know, it wasn't about always winning and everything. I just loved the whole act of it, how you felt, you know, like Superman and everything. And I still like those long distance rides, you know, give me a 100-mile ride, you know, that finishes up real nice. And like like the Trek 100 is a great ride, you know, because you got a real civilized pack, you know, people ride friendly, like, you know, and everything, and they know how to ride. There's some good organized riders in the Midwest, always have been. And it's well supported, you know, perfect support and everything. But I could ride some Grand Fondos for sure. I'll do more, you know. And I want to go to more just the mountain bike events, you know, the crazy stuff. I went to Red Bull last year and as a the in Virgin, Utah.
Oh, the Rampage.
The Rampage.
Rampage. Mm-hmm. That was amazing. And I met a lot of the riders and I went backstage to see how they're doing the productions and everything. And it was so impressive, you know, the riders, especially the really, really good athletes and the people making the courses, you know, they're using algorithms to and math, real mathematics to make this things come true. And that's the thing, you know, you get a really good mountain bike track, you know, that is, you know, a trail or anything. And somebody that really knows what they're doing and you feel like a genius riding the thing. And it's actually safer. You know, you can have your jollies and your thrills and your adrenaline and not be hurting yourself all the time, which is...
Did you ride any of it when you were at Rampage?
No way, man. No. I'm not doing that, but I hung out.
Would younger Gary have done that? Would like a younger Gary Fisher have been like...
Yeah, I could have probably graduated into that whole thing. I was like of the school of like, we didn't get air. We'd hug hug the earth really close, and we'd go fast and everything. But man, these guys they you have to go and practice the thing, you know, and do it properly, mm-hmm. you know, and jump into the airbags and do the mm-hmm. basics and go through the things and get it all together. And it's pretty astounding, and it's an amazing, wonderful thing. I love to see the sport evolving that way, all the time evolving. And, you know, the bikes, what worked a few years ago, oh, brother, forget about it. You know, it's like, come on. The bikes have changed more in the last 5 years than they did in 30 years previous to that. I mean, I will say we got into a real area of being, you know, and I'll be honest, you know, I've dealt with a lot of racers in my life, and a good half of them are completely superstitious, and you change anything on their bike and they will kill you. And they want exactly what the other guys are riding, you know, or else. And then there's the other half that are willing to even think about experimenting. It's really superstitious, you know, in a lot of ways. But the mountain bike area this year, the last 5 years, it's just like these guys are like open to anything. You know, it's wild. And I love it. You know, you got like, and then we got crazy stuff like Travis Brown, checking out that 36er, you know, and there's a lot going on. You know, the mountain bike is not settled. You know what I mean? I went to the UCI, it was like, you know, back around 2000, and argued my case for the 29er and everything. And one thing I was adamant about was like, this whole thing isn't settled. You know, you're going to watch, these bikes are not settled. Road bikes are much more settled. You know, why we do things, you know, why the designs are this way and everything, but mountain bikes, no way. You do not want to mess around with this, you know. And they were coming at me, well, we don't want 700C wheels because guys on cross bikes are going to show up at our World Cups. And I said, that's because your World Cups are not held on mountain bike courses. Get it together, guys. Make a real mountain bike course. I could ride a cross bike.
I'm curious on that theme because, as you say, so much has changed, especially in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Talk about e-bikes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the e-bike is really funny because it's a, like, we've been playing around with this balance of how much power and energy do you need and how much does this whole little thing weigh? And it's really funny because you think all the, you know, people say, oh, it's just a motorbike. Well, a motorbike outweighs the rider by quite a bit. And it really changes the way you handle on the bike and what you do on it and everything. A bicycle, a mountain bike, you know, we do a lot more of shifting our weight back and forth and everything. We outweigh the bike. And so now we're still discovering what the ideal weight and configuration is going to be on the thing, you know, and how it's going to work. But it's just undeniably good fun, you know, all of them.
When you look at the Gary Fisher line, I think was really kind of one of those things. People knew that things would kind of come up first on the Gary Fisher line. Gary Fisher line was never afraid to try new things, whether it's 29ers, different geometry, different paint job, collaboration with designers. Do you have a couple of models or a couple of things that stand out in your head where you think, man, we got that one right? And on the flip side of that, do you have anything that you're like, man, I wish I could get that one back?
To be honest, Eric, I think I got too many of the
latter, not so much of the former.
Yeah, not enough. I mean, they're beautiful little bikes that we made, you know, some of the ones. The bike we were making there in Waterloo with the, you know, the Hukuiku, that was a great little bike. And we did some great incarnations of that bike. And there it was, you know, made in the USA and everything. It's a beautiful little TIG welded frame. That was a good one. And then the Pro Caliber Limited. And it was a 20.5 pound bike, out of the box with pedals. Super.
And I think one question I had too is, where did all these names come from? A lot, if you look back on the line, you had Hukuiku, you had Sugar, you had Fat Possum, you had, Marlin. Marlin. And Marlin has become, you know, one of the most popular selling mountain bikes of all time. And it actually is the entryway for a lot of people to enjoy the sport that you helped create. Where did that inspiration come from when you were sitting there going, that looks like a fat possum to me?
Well, it's got to make you laugh. I mean, that's it. Or make you feel good. You know, it's got to have those things going on, you know. And that's, I mean, names and things like that, that's always, it just comes right out of my stinking head, you know. I do a good job with names. Like, we got a new one now. The other day I was online with our guys and I say, well, we're obviously going to call that an E-caliber. And that would be, you know, the lighter weight. And it stuck, you know. I don't know where that came from. You know, it's like, that's where like, okay, I'm sorry, but you know, it comes from your ancestors. And I got some ancestors that, man, they did poetry, crazy stuff. They were popular with people. I got that hook, that part of it, that small part of it, right? Now we got to make it all come true. That's why I'm with a team. You know, that's what is great about this. I mean, so many, the people joke with me sometimes, oh, you're going to do that one on your own now? You know, as if, you know, I'd prefer to do it on my own because I could do it any old way I wanted to. No. The capabilities here are like much more wild, you know, and I love that, you know. And the end capability really is just having an effect on things, having an effect on things, you know, that's the big thing. And, you know, I mean, our effect at Trek Bike is like, we're going to teach people about a secret that makes us a little bit smug from time to time, you know, and that it's a wonderful thing. And there's some secret formulas, you know, there's like, we could even say 57 things you got to do. And, you know, and it's about how you open things up. You might think this is worse, but it's actually better. You know, that's a surprise to a lot of people. You know, they say, oh, why are you going to take my transit, my goodness away with my beautiful automobile? You know, and they'll say, well, this is why, but we're going to replace it with this other thing, which is far better. And it's just, it's a whole story that has to be told. You know, it's not just, you know, it's not simple. Now, is it? You know, and that's the state what we have to get to. That's where we weren't in 73, you know, in these places. You know, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, but it's not a great idea. The bike sounds like a great idea, but the seat makes my ass hurt and the tires lose air every day and I can't bend over like this. And that's what that bike was then. And plus the cars scare me and every other thing. And it's really funny. I mean, you know, we got 10 years worth of change in 1 year this year. And one of the changes we got is like the cars all went away and the sky got blue. And it blew people's mind how blue it got and how all the animals came back and nature came back and everything. And things slowed down and people spent some time with their kids and their kids, you know, like that.
So I love that you're using your experience and now your platform to create this call to action. Are there some specific things that individuals can do to make these changes stick that are in place short term or bring these new ideas in?
I think it's very important to reach out to others of like mind. We have 45,000 bike activists that are pretty hardcore right here in the United States. We didn't have that in 73 at all. We might have had 45. And these people know the issues, they know the meetings, and then show up to the meetings. And now, you know, once you get hooked in, you know, you're going to know where the meetings are, and the meetings are online. So you can go to a lot of meetings, you know, and put it and learn what's going on and put in your two cents, because things get done with people that show up. And we've been preaching that for a long time now, because when people do show up, we see results. That's it, pure and simple.
Thank you so much for tuning in for this episode of Better with Bikes. If you like what you're hearing, hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode and write a review to help others discover these stories. Thanks for dropping in. We're happy to have you along for the ride.